So about a week before the change of command ceremony, he came to visit me with these sheets of papers, all dog-eared. But here's the data. Can you solve it? Well, fortunately, he did a very good job in collecting and estimating the data. Two, it was not an easy problem in that the molecule was not at all what the chemist thought it should be. It was an entirely different sort of arrangement of atoms. And besides, there was one molecule placed this way, and it was disordered with another one placed in the other direction, but in alternately, well, not alternately, at random, either one orientation or the other orientation. So it took a bit of unraveling, but again, in time, I was able to unravel the structure, and so there was a paper by Carl, and Owen and Horde.
Well, it ought to be mentioned with regard to Tom Owen, but he had a problem that was impossible to solve with the tools that were available at the time. The disorder and the incorrect chemistry just made it impossible to even get a start on the problem.
Did he get a... you said he did at Cornell. Did he get a degree from that, or did...
Well, from other work at crystallography,
yes. Okay.
But this particular problem annoyed him because it was unsolved.
This gets us into the question of your working partnership. You have a relatively unique partnership, being married and being able to interface your work so very well. Could you talk some more about this, how this has affected your work, how it's affected your family life?
Well, there's obviously an overlap in our interests. And I suppose if one had to make some estimate that perhaps 25 to 30% of the work has been collaborative. On the other hand, Isabella has her own research program. She works on all kinds of materials that I do not participate in, and I have my own research program that she doesn't participate in. So I only mention this to point out that it's only partly collaborative. That is not intended to address the fact that in human relationships, people always expect close partners to be arguing with each other. It doesn't happen in our case. It's very simple. We don't feel that either of us threatens our status in the world. We respect each other's talents, which are complementary. And I think there's even a built-in resistance, so far as we're concerned, that we consider a childish foolishness to bring in the kinds of emotions that do often arise when close partners or married people are competing with each other. This just never occurred, and we wouldn't permit it to occur.
Now you've raised a family through all of this as well.
Yes.
That is also an interesting part. Also, from my standpoint, as I recall, at least two of your children are involved in science. And a number of people that I've interviewed, I've found that their children never followed in terms of being science-oriented. So I wanted to pursue that part a little bit, too.
Well, they naturally seem to gravitate toward the natural sciences. As youngsters, we were always curious about how things worked, how bugs crawled, all that sort of thing. My first housekeeper complained most bitterly that she had to empty all these worms, beetles, and so forth from our oldest daughter's jacket before. She could put them in a washing machine, and she didn't appreciate that at all. I think in some sense, we were always partners with our children, in that the oldest daughter did a lot of plotting of density maps when she was really very young. Somebody had to do it, and she enjoyed it. We, as soon as they could more or less look after themselves, started to take them to scientific meetings in the summer time. They were very well-traveled children, went to Europe. Quite a number of times, and they understood very well that they could come along if they would take care of themselves, didn't get into trouble, and so forth. I don't know how serious this was, but our second daughter said that she always thought that she was going to become a scientist because she liked all the travel. But obviously she was interested in science.
I think we helped them without pushing them.
Mm-hmm.
The several instances that I'm familiar with, parents tried very hard to push their youngsters into scientific careers, but it seemed to build up resistance on the part of the children.
May I ask, just for the record, what your children are doing today? I've read it someplace, but just
Well, the eldest one is at Brookhaven National Laboratory, and she does theoretical work on the actions of porphyrins and chlorophylls. That's for me. Excuse me.
Half hour or so will be fine. That's agreeable.
Sure. The oldest daughter is the one who plotted the density diagrams.
Yeah. Actually, she thought that as she was growing up, that biological sciences would be what she was most interested in. And during college, she confided to me that the biological sciences are so messy. And pencil and paper was much to her liking. She has a family of two children. Her husband also is a scientist. And
At Brookhaven.
And at the moment, she's about to leave to give some invited talks at a school in France. She's excited about that. The middle one, Jean, is not married. She works now at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. She works on malaria problems and seems to be quite interested in those. She occasionally collaborates with me on crystal structure analyses of materials that have the new drugs that are being developed in the malaria field. The youngest one did get her bachelor's degree in geology at museum work beckoned, and she's at the Smithsonian in the natural history division.
You had your own institute in the mid-60s, a lab for the structure of matter. Can you give us some background on organization and founding of the lab?
It seemed as if the idea started in the 60s that people who were doing special work successfully might be supported in a different context than the division structure. And several special laboratories were set up about five different laboratories in the history of this lab was set up, maybe six, I'm not exactly sure, I'd have to think about it for a while. At the present time there are still two in extent, this one and the Laboratory for Computational Physics that's headed by Jay Boris. The philosophy behind it was to, in the first place, honor the individuals for their work, but at the same time isolate them as much as possible from administrative duties so that they and their group, which was usually held to some small number, perhaps 10 or 15 people, could concentrate on the research at hand as well as possible. So that was the philosophic basis for setting these laboratories up. And I had the good fortune that I was one of the people for whom such an arrangement was created. I think that I have enjoyed very much the arrangement and that it has been advantageous to the research program.
In what way would you cite it as being advantageous?
Being isolated as a smaller group one might say, well, you could still be a branch in the division. There was more recognition for a laboratory than a branch in a division, and somewhat more consideration for funding stability. So being small, isolated, appreciated, and better funded, I regard as advantages.
And less administrative work than if you were a division head.
Oh, yes. Indeed.
Yes.
As compared to that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where the idea of for organizing individual labs came from? What was the genesis of the idea?
Who originated it? I'm not sure how the idea originated. I'm almost certain that it originated in the administration, such as it was here at the lab, at the time the first ones came up. But who was the director at the time the first ones came up, and where the idea within the administration came up, I really don't know. Someone who might know, who had such an arrangement earlier than I did, would be James Shulman. And so he might be queried on that. He might know.
Were you approached by someone in the administration then in terms of setting it up? Or?
I don't remember exactly how it happened. At that time, I had had from time to time offers to become a division superintendent. And I didn't want to do that because I was certain that it would interfere too much with my research program. And I may have very well said that I have, being quite well aware of ones that had already been set up, I may very well have said that I would prefer and
let's see, Maurice Shapiro already had
one. Zisman had one.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Shulman had one.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can't think offhand of any others, and so with mine and Jay Boris's, mm-hmm. that would make five.
There are only two extant. Is the idea being redeveloped, or what?
I really can't speak for the present administration. I have, from the impression that nothing much has happened for many years, that it's not widely favored, but as I say, I don't really know.
How long did your, we touched on this briefly before, did your work with Hoffman continue? He didn't stay at the lab very long.
He stayed at the lab, but he left our group around 1960 or 61, and actually began to do independent work around 59 and 60. We didn't collaborate that much anymore, even though there are publications that extend beyond. It was just unfinished things that I finished up, and since he had collaborated with me on it, why I included him as a co-author. But things stopped around 59 or 60, and then he had various other positions in the laboratory, but we didn't collaborate.
What was the basis of your earlier collaboration with him? Did you collaborate closely, or what sort of working relationship did you have with Hoffman?
It was very close. He joined our group sometime in late 47, I think it was, and as I probably had mentioned previously, Isabel and I were developing much more precise ways of doing gas electron diffraction structure, and we found this non-negativity principle that was tremendously helpful to us. When Herb first came here, I was thinking about expanding the work on electron diffraction, and he designed, along with a draftsman, an apparatus for doing slow electron diffraction. In other words, the difference was that we normally used what were called fast electrons at the time, an accelerating voltage of about 40 to 50 kilovolts. And the kind of experiments we had in mind would just be done at an acceleration of perhaps anything between 10 and 100 volts instead of kilovolts. And it was an entirely different type of an experiment. It looked very interesting. There were a lot of challenges, so forth. But we became intrigued by the usefulness of this non-negativity principle and the gas electron diffraction. And Herb had had a mathematical background, so I thought, and he agreed, that it would be very interesting to pursue this non-negativity in other fields of research. And it very soon led us into the crystal structure problem because of the characteristic feature that its structure is represented by an electron density distribution in the unit cell, which is a non-negative function. At that point, we worked very closely on the mathematics together. Up until about 1956, when, broadly speaking, we had most of the math. And then after 56, things just naturally started to taper off. And he did collaborate with in some of the earlier structure determinations.
Mm-hmm. I think the first two.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, also with the ones that were done at the survey.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The first two we did here.
And then,
I heard a story, but I'm going to not, rather than repeating it, I'm going to ask you how you heard about the Nobel Prize.
I was at a meeting in Munich, and present there were several colleagues whom I knew well, who were members of the Swedish, Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. They let me know nothing. But I recall one of my good friends at a banquet on the last evening casually coming over to chat with me. And as these discussions often go at the end of the meeting, discussed when we were leaving and how we were going to go. Little did I know that he wanted to know what plane I was going to be on. So about 2 hours before I was landing on a Pan Am trip, which started out in Munich and had a plane change in Heathrow in London, as I say, 2 hours before we landed, an announcement came over the loudspeaker. Started out with telling about the weather in Washington and saying what a nice day it was. And it sounded a little bit strange to me. It was almost one of these captain's announcements which tried to encourage people and then went on to say, so happens we lost a couple of engines, but we'll get there anyway. You know? But he got around to saying that he doesn't know it, but the latest recipient of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry is aboard. And thoughts quickly went through my mind, I must admit, that Had this been an announcement for the United States or something like that, I wouldn't have paid too much attention to it, but I figured with 300 people on an airplane, I had a pretty good chance. So he said my name, said where I was sitting, and suggested I come up to first class. So I'm glad that I was informed 2 hours before the plane landed, because there was a huge number of reporters at the airport and all sorts of microphones and so forth. If this were thrust on me without knowing what was happening, I don't know if I could have had as much composure as I did, but I had time to regain my composure, and I could handle the rest of the events. That's how it happened.
Interesting. What was the reaction of the people on the plane?
Oh, they were delighted. They stood up and cheered, and I had to stand up, and they saw who I was, and so forth. It was a very nice event.
It's probably one of the most unique ways of announcing it, I would think.